Morning. If you've looked at your notices, you will notice that the title for this sermon is "I'm Not Qualified to Do This," and I hasten to explain that this is not the self-assessment of your preacher. We are in the midst of a series of arguments between man and God, between God's heroes and the Lord Himself, and. Today we're coming to near the end of that series, and we meet Moses making excuses. So today it's not so much about arguments as excuses, valid excuses, ridiculous excuses, excuses to make us smile, perhaps. And I was thinking, well, you know, if we sing a song here called "Be Brave, Be Bold, for the Lord your God is with you. I'm not afraid, I will not be dismayed, I'm walking in faith and victory." Well, if that's you this morning, then I rejoice for you, but this sermon really isn't for you. It's not really aimed at those of us who are walking in faith and victory. On the other hand, if it is for you, if you feel stretched and tired and a bit daunted by all the things that you're up against, and it's for you if you wonder whether you're fighting a losing battle and managing just to do the things you have to do without really getting around to the things that you want to do. And it's particularly for you if today you're struggling a little bit with your spiritual life, and if you haven't much time to study the Bible, if you're wondering whether your prayer life is going to pot, and certainly wondering whether you would be able to take on any more a Christian service. Well, if this morning you're probably in a situation that Moses was in, where he was asked to do a great thing by God, and like you, like me, he found very good excuses, very good reasons for saying no. And we will be looking at why Moses was so reluctant to do what God asked him to do, and then we'll be looking at God's response to and various responses to those arguments. Talking about excuses, I spend a part of each week going around a hospital, going from bed to bed as part of a Christian chaplaincy team, saying hello to patients, and because we're in a hospital, we're not allowed to evangelize sick people. But we can only talk to them about faith if they invite it, although we can, of course, offer to pray for them. And however, even though we don't encourage talk or we don't initiate talk about faith, inevitably, because of who we are, patients will volunteer their opinions about faith. They feel they have to give me some reason why they don't go to church, because the majority of them don't, why they've stopped going to church, why they never take their children to church. And most of the excuses actually sound pretty plausible until you translate them to another sphere of activity, and then they can sound pretty silly. I amused myself the other day by imagining that I was visiting patients not as part of the Christian Fellowship of the hospital, but as a member of Charlton Athletic Football Club. And I imagine Charlton sending out, I say this with respect to Amour, who's sitting there and is a Charlton coach, I imagine Charlton sending out footballers to visit people in hospital. And I imagined myself in my red shirt, Charlton shirt with my shorts, going from bed to bed, not initiating any talk about footballing, but getting all sorts of unsolicited reasons why people don't like football, don't go to football, have given up football, or don't take their children to football. In other words, suppose we swap the words church, faith, and religion for the word football. And here are some of the excuses that you might get. Well, I stopped going because every time I went to football, they were appealing for money. They weren't very friendly. Some weeks, they more or less ignored me. I don't go to football because the benches are hard and uncomfortable. The coach never came to visit me. The referee makes decisions that I don't agree with. The games are always scheduled at times when I have something else to do. Some games went into overtime and made me late getting home. I don't like all those rules and restrictions. I feel everyone should be allowed to play according to his or her own rules, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. I've read all the books about football, and I know as much about the game as any club player. You don't actually have to join a football club to be a footballer. For me, my football is a private, intensely personal matter. I don't feel I need to share it with anyone else. My parents took me to too many football games when I was growing up. It's ridiculous. I don't take my children to football because I want them to choose for themselves which sport they like best. Anyhow, let's be serious. Moses had similarly implausible excuses for not doing what God wanted him to do. He had four principal ones. The first was, I'm unworthy. And the second one was, nobody will believe me. And the third one, I can't speak in public. And the fourth was, please send someone else. I'm not the right man for the job. And I'd like to take them one by one and see what God said and how these apply to us. In the previous chapter, in the one before we started reading, in chapter 3 of Exodus, Moses says to the Lord, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh to bring the Israelites out of Egypt? You see, his last attempt at trying to do something for the Israelites had ended in disaster. He'd been raised as a prince of Egypt, as you remember, and then he murdered an Egyptian who was abusing an Israelite, and then his own people turned against him, saying, you know, who made you a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you killed that Egyptian yesterday? So he fled, he ran away. And he was a fugitive from the law. And then for 40 years, he lived in the desert as a shepherd, the lowest status job imaginable. And he'd been humbled. He'd been smitten by God. And how would someone in his position ever get into the presence of Pharaoh and survive? Here was the God King of Egypt. It must have seemed an impossible task. A couple of hundred years later, when the Israelites once again messed up their lives and find themselves under oppression under the Midianites, God had a similar conversation with Gideon. The angel of the Lord appears to Gideon and says, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Gideon was in hiding at the time and feeling anything but mighty. And Gideon replies, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all the wonders that our fathers told us about? And I wonder how many of us today find ourselves in that place, wondering, why has God let all these things happen to me? What has happened to all the miracles I heard about? Have you ever asked about all those unanswered prayers? Well, Moses certainly felt, both literally and metaphorically, in the wilderness, being a shepherd, and in many ways could have felt, I mean, he was 80 years old after all, could have felt that his useful life had come to an end. And when he had tried to do good to the Israelites, he had failed. So why should things be any different now? Well, God said to Moses, go. And what was the difference? Well, 40 years ago, he'd done it in his own strength. And now he was doing it in the strength of God, or asked to do it in the strength of God. God says to Moses, as he would later say to Gideon, don't be afraid, for I am with you. Do you know, someone once took the trouble to count how many times in the Bible God says, don't be afraid, I am with you, or some variation of those words. And they counted 366 times, once for every day of the year, plus the next one for the leap year. So just to reassure us that God is with us. It's the most frequent assurance we find in the Bible, I'm told. You see, what matters is not Moses' status. It's not about who Moses is, but whose Moses is. That's as true for us today as it was 3,500 years ago. When it comes to building God's kingdom, whether it's arranging flowers in St. John's or serving as street pastors, which we're going to hear about a bit later, or as mentors in Blue Coat School, it's less important that those that we serve discover who we are than that they discover whose we are, that we belong to the Lord and we do it in His name. Moses' second excuse was, no one will believe me. Even if he got there, why should Pharaoh or anyone else for that matter believe a lowly shepherd? And God replies that to that question by saying, what's that in your hands? And Moses says, a staff. And God tells him to throw the staff into the ground, as we've read today, and it turns into a snake. Now the snake, the staff is an insignificant object, but it's transformed into something that has the power of God in it, a powerful weapon. And for the Egyptians, as you may know, the snake was a symbol of Pharaoh's power. If you look at the advertisements for the Tutankhamun exhibition down at the Dome, you'll see the pictures of King Tutankhamun. He's got a snake on the front of his headgear. And it won't have been lost on Pharaoh that Moses' staff, turning into a snake, would be a signal that there's something greater at work, a greater power at work than that of Pharaoh. And it's amazing how often God uses the little things that we have in our hands to accomplish His purposes. Moses' staff would lead the people out of captivity. It would part the Red Sea. It would bring water from the rock. And there are many other examples in the Bible where God uses very weak, insignificant instruments. In the book of Judges, chapter 15, we see Samson murdering or killing 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. In 1 Samuel 17, we see David with 5 little stones and a slingshot bringing down mighty Goliath. In Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 12, we read how the poor widow had one little handful of flour and the last few drops of oil, and a miracle was worked of multiplication by God's power through Elijah. And an even greater miracle is worked in John chapter 6, where a boy's lunch, just a few little loaves of barley and pita bread and a couple of small fishes, are turned into something that can feed 5,000. And then Jesus was more impressed by the widow's little coins than he was by the surplus gift, the gold coming from the rich man. And what does God say to us through those stories of weak instruments, of limited little resources? He says, what's that in your hand? He says to you and me. And as we show him the little we have, metaphorically speaking, he takes our limited time, he takes our limited resources, and as we offer them back to him, give them back to him, he multiplies them and uses them to build his kingdom. See, in 1 Corinthians 1, chapter 27, it says, but God chooses the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. He chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things to nullify the things that are. So it's a sign. So let's never underestimate, you and I, let's not underestimate what God can do with even the very little that we have. What matters is not how little we have in our hands, but how willing we are to do what Moses is, to cast it down, to hand it over to God and let him bless it. In an unbelieving world in which we live, people will believe you as Moses was believed by Pharaoh when they see how the little we have is mightily used by God. Moses' next excuse was, I can't speak in public. This is interesting because if you know your New Testament, you know that in Acts 7, verse 22, we read that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. And I couldn't help wondering what had happened to him. I mean, he must have somehow got de-skilled in the 40 years that he was watching sheep on Mount Horeb. What is it that happened to him? And then I reflected on other similar situations, and I reflected on his life, and I thought, well, Moses lived 120 years, we know that, and 40 years he lived in the king's palace, a place of education and privilege, where he developed many skills. And the next 40 years he lived in the wilderness as a shepherd, a place of frustration and preparation. And then the last 40 years of his life, he would find himself in a place of leadership and of perseverance where he needed to really carry through, endure. But in Moses' eyes, those years in the wilderness might have seemed a real waste of time, where gradually all his skills, everything he'd picked up in the royal court of Egypt, would be lost forever. I spent some years of my life working for the Home Office, in prison officer education. And that job took me from Cleland House, the headquarters in London, to Wakefield, the prison training college, and around the various prisons, not to talk to prisoners, but to deal with prison staff. And I found in my travels that the prison service attracted some very fine men and women who had given up other, often very highly skilled jobs and occupations to join a service where they spend most of their working life living on landings, endlessly locking and unlocking doors and gates, and overseeing prisoners going through their monotonous daily routine. And one of the most common complaints I used to hear from prison officers is that the skills they'd acquired in their previous occupations had somehow got lost. And I wonder whether maybe you've experienced something like that. Maybe the de-skilling effect of years of rearing children, or perhaps you're in a job, or you've been in a job for a long period that never used the things that you so painstakingly acquired during your studies. Well, take heart. The Bible promises that God will restore to you and to me the years that the locusts have eaten. Moses was eloquent once, but he was eloquent no longer. But God says, I will help you to speak. I will teach you what to say. Jesus would say something similar to his disciples later on when he told them that they should not worry about what to say when they come before kings and magistrates, but that the Holy Spirit would give them the words. I wonder how many of us here have had that experience of just giving the right word to someone at the right time. And you may not even have known what you were saying. I mean, it's happened to me. Just weren't even aware of what you were saying, but it turned out to be exactly what that person needed to hear and may have changed his or her life. I'm sure that I can tell just by looking at you that several of us have had that very experience. You see, God uses very ordinary people and uses ordinary speech to bring his word to others. And you don't have to go to Bible college or seminary before God uses you. He will take the little you have in your hands and he will multiply it. He will supply what you lack. Because you see, God is less interested in your ability than he is in your availability. And then Moses has that fourth excuse. He says, oh, please send someone else. I'm not your man. Now, this is very serious. It's probably the most serious complaint of all, because it actually challenges God's judgment. In spite of all the signs, in spite of God's promises of assurance of being with him, in spite of the wonders that he works, Moses says, oh, Lord, please send someone else. And then we read that God's anger burned against Moses. A truth that you and I need to take on board is that God gets angry at our excuses. He created you and me to know him, to love him, and to serve him. He has demonstrated his power to us in various ways. He has provided us with all we need, and he's called us to serve him with whatever we have in our hands. And in spite of all our limitations, he assures us again and again that he is with us, and yet some of us still say no. And our excuses not only anger God, but they cause discouragement in the body of Christ. Do you know that our excuses force a few to carry the weight of many? Beware of using what you can't do as an excuse for not doing what you can do. The Bible teaches us that one day we will be called to account for the excuses that we have given. They'll be shown up to be just excuses. The futility of excuses is one of the key teachings of Jesus' ministry. In Matthew 25, Jesus gives us a rather scary picture of a last judgment when the nations will be gathered before God, and he will separate the sheep to his right and the goats on his left, and he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat, and I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me. I needed clothes, and you didn't clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me." And they also will answer, "Lord, when? When did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you?" And he will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of these, the least of these, you did not do for me." And then they will go away to eternal punishment. This morning, many of us have come to church feeling tired, stressed, overcommitted with our resources, maybe stretched to the very limit. But we are exactly the kind of people that God has always used and will always use to fulfill his purposes. He never asks us to give him what we don't have. He wants our hearts, and he wants whatever little we do have. If today we hear God's voice, let's respond to it, and let's not use the little we don't have to give the little we do have, and let's not use what we can't do as an excuse for not doing the things that we can do.